2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, Ruth Adelson and Hope Layton, interviewing Leonard Scheinholz, January the 12th, 1999. Leonard, would you please tell us the name of your favorite restaurant and where it's located?
My favorite restaurant? Depends on the area of the country that you're talking about.
Pick an area and pick a restaurant.
New York, Danielle's.
Okay. Near Pittsburgh.
You know about my 10 Within 10 program, don't you?
Your what?
My 10 Within 10 program?
No.
Well, for a fee, which I haven't yet set, I give you an 800 number, which I don't yet have. And you call me on that number and you say, Len, I'm at the corner of 53rd and Madison Avenue in New York City, and it's noon, and I'll give you 10 restaurants within 10 blocks of that payphone.
Whenever you get organized, let me know. The reason that we came back is because I neglected to ask you about your affiliation with the Duquesne Club.
Well, let's see if I can answer that for you. I've probably been a member since, I think, 1978. The first Jewish members of the Duquesne Club probably were admitted in about 1970 or 71. The very first was Bob Hainsferther, who was a vice president of Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company. And after that, I guess in the next couple of years, there were two or three others. I was probably, at a guess, the fourth or fifth member of the Duquesne Club. Now, there are probably, at a guess, maybe 100 Jewish members of the Duquesne Club. I don't know. I never counted them, but there are a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that in today's climate, there's absolutely no prejudice against Jewish members.
Okay, as long as they have the qualifications.
Qualifications, yeah.
How was it being a member when there were only a few?
No problem at all. Never been a problem.
I have to ask you a question that occurred to me when I was thinking about coming today.
Yeah.
Would you have given a bar mitzvah luncheon there?
Would I? Uh-huh. That's a very good question. I'm not sure I would have.
Okay.
But they have them today.
I know.
But at that time in 78, probably, I don't know.
Okay. Maybe yes.
Maybe no.
Maybe no. Probably no.
Well, I don't know.
No. Okay. You also, when we listened to your tape again, you mentioned that AAA opened up all new experiences for you. Could you tell us something about what it brought to you?
It depends on which AAA you're talking about. I was on the board of two AAAs.
Oh, I
keep the American Arbitration Association and the American Automobile Association.
Oh, I think you mentioned the Automobile Association.
Okay. The Automobile Association, first of all, gave me experiences that I didn't have as a lawyer in travel and in investments and things of that kind.
What do you mean in travel?
Well, the AAA being a travel-oriented organization, we went to conventions and they put heavy emphasis on travel-related activities.
Mm-hmm. You mean to adjudicate them to be?
No, to.
Weren't you the chairman, or?
I was the chairman of the board of the West Penn Motor Club.
Okay, so how did travel relate to your chairmanship?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question. As chairman, I oversaw the operations of the club. There was a full-time paid president or At one time, I guess he was the executive vice president, who was the paid professional, and he handled the day-to-day operations. And as chairman of the board, you know, I convene board meetings, appoint a committee chairman. We did a host of other things that related to travel, because it is a travel-oriented organization.
Sure. Right. It's. Am I right in saying that it's travel in two ways? One is rescuing travelers.
Yeah. That's Emergency Road Service.
Right.
But the other part of it is they do a lot of planning trips, triptychs, things of that kind.
Okay. You've had a long and I think exemplary career. Were there any cases that you found, if I may coin a phrase, did you have any landmark cases?
Yeah, I think I did. A number that come to mind, right in front of you she's got her coffee cup on it, is a jury verdict in a case that we had down in Birmingham, Alabama for USX, where the USX and the steelworkers were defendants in a case that went on for probably 8 or 9 years. It was a jury trial case brought by some dissident employees at the U.S. steel plant down in that area, and the good lawyers on the other side, and I think steelworkers had some excellent lawyers, and we had a team, and the trial took about 3 to 4 weeks, but the pretrial maneuvering and depositions and things like that took 8 years.
Really?
Yeah, and we got a defense verdict on a claim on the claims that where they were asserting RICO claims and other types of claims for $1 to $3 billion, depending on the statute that was involved, and to get a jury verdict in favor of a company and a labor union in Birmingham is almost unheard of.
That's almost a miracle.
Well,
I would think.
Yeah, we were very pleased with it. A couple of other cases, I had two cases in the Supreme Court. One was the Gateway Coal Company case, which a very frequently cited case. Another was a case for Westinghouse Broadcasting. Another case that comes to my mind is a case called the Fash case. Fash was a group of renegade truckers called the Fraternal Association of Steel Haulers. And they almost shut the steel industry down in 1967. And they tried to shut it down again in 1970. In 1967, we were magnificent. We got injunctions every place in western Pennsylvania for the steel companies, but the injunctions weren't worth the paper they were printed on because they were loaned to the plant gates and the sheriffs wouldn't enforce them. As a result, the injunctions were ineffective to do what we wanted them to do. So we knew that there had to be a better way, and that better way was the Sherman Act. The only problem with the Sherman Act is that it doesn't apply to a labor organization. And when they went to shut down the industry in 1970, got the idea that maybe we could make these steel haulers into small independent businessmen. This was a sham union. A group of businessmen who owned their own trucks. They really weren't employees of steel haulers as such, and therefore the Sherman Act might apply. And we got an injunction, which effectively prevented a lot of violence on the roads, because there was, it was a quite a violent work stoppage. They did the same thing again in 1978, and we used the 1970 injunction to enforced it against them in 1978. The leader of FASH was within about 10 minutes of going to jail because the judge said to him, "You're going to call this work stoppage off?" And there were marshals on either side of him, and eventually he said yes. He called it off, and that was the end of it. So that was another case that I thought was different than the run-of-the-mill case. And the thing that I think maybe I probably pride myself on the most is our negotiation of the labor agreements that permitted the Post-Gazette to take over the Pittsburgh Press from the Scripps Howard people. The press for many, many years was a party to a joint operating agreement with the Post-Gazette, where under which the press provided, they printed the paper, they distributed the paper, and the Post-Gazette had a one department, the editorial department. They wrote the stories for the Post-Gazette. The press had its own editorial department, but everything else the press did for the Post-Gazette. Well, when the press decided they were going to change things and tighten up, the Teamsters in particular, but the other unions, the pressmen and a number of the other labor unions, did not agree. A number of them went on strike and effectively shut down not only the press but the Post-Gazette, to the point where the press finally decided to throw in the towel and sell the paper. And they offered it to Bill Block. He agreed to buy it subject to condition that he negotiate satisfactory labor agreements with the 10 unions that had 13 contracts with the press. We had 30 days to do it, and that was in November of 1993, I believe, or 94, I'm not sure which.
Is that when we didn't have a paper?
That's right. Yeah.
That's when I really became a New York Times.
Yeah, well, I hope you're back with the Post Gazette. Anyhow,
I read it.
We started in, and we got agreements with every one of the unions by the deadline that that they had in the sales agreement. The Justice Department couldn't believe that we could do it. They wanted to know what did we do that the press people didn't do. And it was very simple. We listened.
That's what you said you do.
Oh, huh?
That's what you said you do. That's your
and so we got the agreements, and they were back in business.
Well, that must have been wonderful.
That was a thrill.
I bet it was thrilling. Anything else that comes to mind?
No, those are the ones that
ones that excited you the most.
Right.
Then I listened again to the tape, and I learned that you do a considerable amount of lecturing.
I do.
The American Arbitration Association. I want to get it on tape. The American Management Association, Practicing Law Institute, and the Federal Bar Association.
Right.
Do you still lecture for these?
I haven't recently,
you
no.
Haven't. What kind of lectures? Where did you go?
The American Arbitration Association would have training classes for arbitrators, or they would have symposiums where people that are interested in arbitration would attend, and they would have a program. I'd be on the program. But I'm not the only one. I mean, there are lots of people that do this. Federal Bar Association is the same thing. The American Management Association has a very comprehensive programs for business executives, some of which deal with labor-related matters. And They would get lawyers from around the country to give talks to their members.
So they would understand maybe better what their options are.
Sure.
Things of that sort. Okay. Then I read or heard that you're in several volumes, such as Best Lawyers in America, Who's Who in American Law, Who's Who in America, and Who's Who in the World.
Well, that's true. I'm not that particularly proud of it, but that it happens to be a fact.
How does it happen?
You get a letter from them.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Asking?
Well, they ask you for, they say that, for example, Best Lawyers in America, they come to people who are in the community and they say, here are a list of the areas that we're interested in. Who are the best lawyers in your area in these subjects, and you're recommended, and they, if enough people recommend you, then you're in the book.
I think that must make you feel good.
Well,
why not?
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, one other thing.
Yeah.
That I'm, this is a special interest of mine. When we went down on the elevator when we left, you mentioned your interest in food, and you got all smiley, and I felt all smiley, and I wondered if you could tell us something about how you became interested in food and fine food, and
well,
could you tell us something about it?
Yeah, I've been an eater for many years.
That'll help.
And to me, that's a form of relaxation. Some people play golf. Some people go to Atlantic City and gamble. I like to eat.
Good. Where do you like to go? What kind of a restaurant?
Well, the only thing I don't like is Greek food.
Greek?
Yeah, other than that, you name it, I love it.
You like it. Asian food?
Asian food.
Indian food?
Indian food I don't like either. That's just, no. But Italian, French, Chinese, you know, I love them. Even continental.
If you could have one dinner that would be perfect, what would be your perfect dinner? From soup to nuts, you know, from beginning to end. Give me one great menu.
Your calories are not an issue.
Not an issue.
Huh?
Just pleasure.
Well, that's
the way you used to eat in the old days.
Before my bypass.
You don't know how to do any better anymore.
Well, I guess crab meat hoselle, for example, and roast fillet of beef.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
When I ate beef, I don't have beef that much, but.
Okay. But you like a fillet
yeah.
of beef.
Yeah. Roast potatoes, string beans, a salad, tossed salad with the Roquefort dressing on top. Yeah, I'm not crazy about desserts. I could.
Oh, you're lucky.
I would rather have the other stuff.
You're very lucky. That's a very simple menu. It isn't anything very complicated.
No. My tastes are very simple. Just that I eat a lot of it.
And you like good quality.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to go. Do you have to go to a restaurant like Danielle to get a fillet of beef?
No.
You
no.
have it at
yeah.
Chris, I guess, or Morton's?
But Danielle's has very, I think, a very good food, well prepared. The only problem with Danielle's, at least the old Danielle's, was the space. You were so crowded. Have you ever been there?
No.
Well, you're practically in your in the lap of the person sitting next to you, and it was too bunched in. But other than that, it was a wonderful restaurant.
Do you read Ruth Reichel in the New York Times?
Yeah.
She writes very well, I think. Do you cook?
No.
Okay.
My wife would like me to, though.
Well, I just wondered if your interest in food went over to Ruthie, do you have any other questions? You answered everything so well.
All right. One other, going back to, you said what are the cases that I had that I...
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
One other one that I'm particularly proud of occurred back in 1983. The steel industry in 1983 bargained jointly with the steelworkers. They had a group that they called the Coordinating Committee Steel Company, CCSC. And that was U.S. Steel, Bethlehem, J&L, Inland. There were about seven or eight companies that bargained jointly with steelworkers. That year they got, because of the conditions in the steel industry, they got a concessionary agreement, which was signed March 1 of 1983. The ink wasn't dry on the agreement when they disagreed about what they had agreed upon. And so they decided to submit the disputes concerning the their disagreements to final and binding arbitration. They picked Professor Ben Aaron, who is probably one of the five top arbitrators in the country. He's a professor out at UCLA on the West Coast. The claims essentially involved the effect of the concessions. Did they apply to certain things like cost of living, like severance, things of that kind? And these are benefits, essentially benefits. Right. And did the concessions extend to those benefits, or did they simply extend to the wages? And the amount involved, probably, we used to say that it was $100 million that was involved. Actually, given the extent of the layoffs in the steel industry and the impact that they had on these concessions, or the concessions had on the industry, probably closer to $200 million. My guess is it was the biggest industrial arbitration to date. I don't know of any that involved claims that were any larger than we had in this arbitration at any other company and union in the country. In the end, we probably got about 90% of what we were seeking. I was representing the steel industry, the whole industry. The lawyer on the other side was a guy who, good friend of mine, his name is Michael Gottesman, probably one of the top union lawyers in the country, bar none.
Is he a Pittsburgher?
No, he's from Washington. There's some Gottesmans here, but I don't know whether they're... They're from McKeesport, I think.
I think so.
I'm not sure that he's related to them. But he teaches now at Georgetown Law School. Very, very fine guy and a good lawyer. And everybody talks about the Karen Silkwood case and Jerry Spence. You know who Karen Silkwood was?
No.
She was the woman who worked at Kerr McGee. She was killed before her case came up. It involved the impact of nuclear.
Was that a movie?
Yes, they made a movie of it.
What was her name?
Karen Silkwood.
Oh, Silkwood. Oh, yeah. Sure, I know that.
Anyhow, Jerry Spence was her lawyer.
Uh-huh.
The only problem was that Jerry Spence didn't win that case. The case was won by Mike Gottesman before the Supreme Court on the key issue, and that was whether the Nuclear Regulatory Act applied and preempted the state courts from litigating her tort claim.
Uh-huh. So it was not a sort of technicality.
And Mike had argued that and won it, that there was no preemption, that the states were free to litigate the tort claims of employees who worked for companies like Kerr McGee. Then Jerry Spence settled the case after that. He always takes credit for it, but the tough work was done by Mike Gottesman.
So he had his day in court too.
Who?
Gottesman.
Yeah.
That's good.
Mike also had a case that I was involved in tangentially. One day back in the late 70s, I got a call from Northwest Airlines, from the general counsel of Northwest Airlines at 8 a.m. in the morning. Now, there in Minneapolis, that meant that the general counsel was in his office by 7 or earlier. And they had a stewardess by the name of Mary Ann Laffey, who was a very good stewardess, but she wanted to be a purser, and they didn't want to make her a purser. And purser is somebody like a, well, it's a very interesting question. Purser, at least at that point in time, was on international flights. They were all male.
Okay.
And they had stewardesses, but they had a purser, and he would take care of certain things that...
He was like the chief petty officer.
Right, yeah, yeah. But anyhow, they were all male, and she wanted to be a purser, and they didn't want to make her a purser. They horsed her around for about 3 or 4 years, forced her to go to her union. Her union decided they couldn't take the case because they were party to labor agreements that might become involved. So the lawyer for the union sent her to Mike Gosman. Hello. Hi, Janet, let me call you back in a few. But one quick question. Abby Snyderman, who's her husband? Milstein. Did you see he just bought the Washington Redskins for $800 million? Huh? Okay. All right. Okay. Do you know Janet Spear?
Janet Spear, I do.
Yeah, yeah, let's see that one. She has a relative who, by the name of Abby Snyderman, married to a guy by the name of Milstein. And I think he's the one that was in the paper today as having purchased the Washington Redskins for $800 million.
What does he do?
He's a banker, I think.
Oh, I guess.
anyhow, so they went to Mike Gottesman. Gottesman decided not only could he get Mary Ann Laffey a job as a purser, but that there was unequal pay between female flight attendants and males. So he brought an action against Northwest Airlines in Washington under the anti-discrimination laws, both with respect to the purser issue, but with respect to the treatment of females in general in the airline industry. And the judge decided in his favor, and they asked me to evaluate the case. I looked at it, I said, you know, if I were you, I would try to settle that case right now before it goes any further. By my calculations, you owe about maybe $25 million right now, and not including counsel fees. I think you could probably settle this thing at this stage for between $5 and $6 million, including counsel fees. And as I know Gottesman, he's a good lawyer, you know, if you want me to, I'd be willing to talk to him. Well, the guy who had represented Northwest Airlines almost had a stroke. He was sitting there, and you could see the veins go up in his neck. Anyhow, they thanked me, and they had brought in, there were two of us. They brought in another guy by the name of Chuck Backley from Los Angeles, and the common, to evaluate it too, the common ingredient that we both had was we had just argued cases before the Supreme Court and won for management. And so they thought to give us a look at it. And he agreed with me that in my evaluation, well, they didn't do what we wanted. Ultimately, they lost everything, and they ended up paying $52 million, not including Gottesman's lawyer's fees. When we were out in Los Angeles in 83, he said to me one day when we were during a hearing, he says, Len, would you mind if we didn't start exactly at 2? I said, why? He said, well, I have a conference call on a fee that I application I have on a case, and the judge is going to talk to us at 5 o'clock his time, 2 o'clock here. And I said, sure. It turned out that was a Laffey case. And he got about $4 to $5 million, I think.
He did.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right? Well, they should have listened. All right, one other question. Could you say a little bit about bringing a case before the Supreme Court? Is there anything special about it?
Well, number one, you have to understand that there are probably...
Why don't we turn it over? Because I think this would be.
Because you're going to.